Good morning. Thank you so much for being here, members and visitors alike. What a wonderful blessing it is to gather with brothers and sisters in Christ on the first day of the week. And hopefully to draw encouragement from God's Word and from one another. That is our effort, of course, always, and hopefully that was what we're going to accomplish today. I'm going to turn your attention toward Isaiah chapter 46 this morning, a passage that we read a few moments ago. I have been increasingly drawn to the book of Isaiah over the last, 6 months or so. Maybe this is going to be my next big project. I don't know. It's a fascinating book that I've grown to appreciate a lot more this year. And for whatever reason, I'm not exactly sure why, but for whatever reason, the last couple of weeks, I have found it impossible to get away from this chunk of text in Isaiah toward the middle to latter part of the book. Most of you are aware that Isaiah is roughly split into two parts. That Isaiah breaks in half after chapter 39. The first part of Isaiah is talking largely about the coming destruction upon the nation of Israel and the nation of Judah. Isaiah is writing as the northern kingdom. The northern tribes are falling apart, essentially. He is prophesying as Assyria takes the northern tribes into captivity. He is prophesying to the southern kingdom, saying, you're essentially on the same path, and you are fated for the same doom, and you need to repent. And the latter part of the book is talking largely, and there are overlaps, of course, but the second part of the book is talking largely about what happens after this. Here's the condemnation. We're already looking forward to the time that they're going to be taken into captivity. Well, what's going to happen now? And the plan that God had for his people. And there's the second half of the book of Isaiah is even more messianic than the first half, which is considerably messianic. And God is assuring them that he has a plan for them and that there's going to be light at the end of the tunnel, not only in the short term after the 7 years in Babylon is completed, although Isaiah doesn't specifically talk about that, but after this chastening process is over, there's a greater reality that's coming in Jesus. And we're looking forward to that tremendously, of course. Now, I've especially been focusing in the 40s, around chapter 42 to chapter 49. Chapter 42 and chapter 49 both talk about this great servant that we know more famously probably from Isaiah 53. This servant, of course, is talking about Jesus, who's going to come onto the scene and proclaim God's glory in a marvelous, marvelous way. But especially around chapter 44 to about chapter 47 or so, God is essentially reintroducing himself to this nation. Again, looking forward to the time that they're going to be chastened and hopefully brought to repentance. They need to remember who God is and what God is all about. And I'm going to be planning, anyway, to spend quality time, a lot of time over the next few weeks, talking about the God's presentation of himself in this context. And I'm hoping to spend maybe 3 weeks or so talking about that. But before I get into that, there is a chunk of text within the chunk of text that especially grabbed my attention. Here in chapter 46, in the first few verses, talking about this God who says he will carry them through the coming days. And that is a tremendously powerful image. And I think that if you look at the screen up in on top here, and you see Hal's going to preach a lesson, and it's going to be entitled, "I Will Carry You." And it's in quotation mark, like it's God speaking to us. That may touch you where you live right now. Because you may feel like you need to be carried. You may feel at your particular moment in life, a particular juncture in your particular walk with Christ, or your struggles with the world, that you need to be carried. And the idea of serving a God who is there for you, who will lift you up, who will bear you on his back, is a tremendously encouraging kind of thing. And I think we're going to touch on a little bit of that as we go. I'd like to start, though, by reading the text again. We read it a few moments ago, but I want to read it again. In chapter 46, if you haven't already turned there, and I would encourage you to spend some time here later on if you want to review this and look back at the way that God presents himself here through the prophet Isaiah. And again, look at this in the context of the pending Babylonian captivity. Isaiah doesn't have a lot of details about what's going to happen, although he does name Cyrus by name as the one who's going to end that captivity. But he is prophesying of this time when the people are going to be taken captive. And look at what he writes here in verse number 1. Bel and Nebo are idols, essentially. And they take a very important role in this text. Bel has bowed down. Nebo stoops over. Their images are consigned to the beasts and the cattle. The things that you carry are burdensome, a load for the weary beast. They stooped over. They have bowed down together. They could not rescue the burden, but they have themselves gone into captivity. Listen to me, O house of Jacob, and all the remnant of the house of Israel. You have been born by me from birth and have been carried from the womb. Even to your old age, I will be the same. And even to your graying years, I will bear you. I have done it. And I will carry you. And I will bear you. And I will deliver you. This imagery here is amazing to me. Here is a nation that already is failing to learn the lesson of the northern tribes. They are given over far too much, and they're going to be exceedingly given over to these idols. And Isaiah prophesies about this day when finally, worst case scenario has happened, and they are having to leave the promised land and go to this foreign land because some foreign power has forced them to do it. And they've been forced to do this by God because of their idolatry. And as they are packing up to go, they're getting everything loaded up. They got their camels, they got their donkeys, they got their children, whoever happens to be your pack animal of choice. And they're getting everything packed up, and they come to their idol. And maybe it's made out of stone. And maybe it's overlaid by silver or by gold. It may take two of you to carry this thing. But with a great deal of effort, you grab this idol and you lift it up and you carry it over to an already overburdened pack animal and you put it on his back so that you can carry this idol to Babylon with you. Isn't that just a preposterous notion? You've been entrusting your life to this piece of stone, and now here it is, for time for you to move. It can't even move itself. You are burdening yourself with a load that is contrary to your best interest, he says. This is contrasted by the God who does not need to be carried, who in fact will carry you through these hard times, if you will allow him to, if you will trust in him. Physically, spiritually, emotionally, he will bear the burden instead of you having to bear him. Now, there are three points of application that I'd like to make here with regard to this business of God carrying us. And first of all, those are the most important way in which he carries us. And then secondly, we'll talk about the way that is most central to the imagery of the actual text. The one that's borne out the best by the language of the text. And then we'll get around to the emotional one, the one that you were hoping I was going to talk about. We'll talk about that in a little bit also. But we'll talk about all three of these. First of all, though, look at this. I got that. I'm about to run out of power. Excuse me. Okay, first of all, the first way that God carries us is that he carries us like a passenger. And I say this as the most important one because if you don't understand the concept of being saved by grace, this is where we have to start. God carries us in the sense that he is the one who is assuming responsibility for our salvation. Now, there's a role for us to play. We'll touch on that a little bit as we go. But while we are preaching the necessity of baptism and obedience and purity and holiness and all the great things that we talk about and should talk about, the Bible talks about these things. Let us never lose sight of who ultimately is doing the carrying. God is going to carry us. God does the saving, and so therefore God is the one who gets the credit. These
gods, foreign gods, idolatrous gods, had themselves to be carried into this foreign land. They had to be saved. If the people weren't going to save them, they weren't going to be saved. They were just going to leave, you know, stay there and become tarnished or stolen by the invaders or whatever. Their fate was entirely up to the people. Our fate is entirely up to God. God is the one who does the saving. And whatever preaching we do on baptism or the rest of it, we need to make sure we do not lose sight of this. Old King James Version, I believe, and maybe some other versions in Acts chapter 42, verse 42, talk about Peter exhorting them, save yourselves from this crooked generation. That's not the right verse, is it?
Let me double check on that. I hate having wrong verses up there. Acts chapter 2 and verse number 40, I apologize for that. With many other words, he solemnly testified and kept on exhorting them, saying, be saved, the New American Standard Version says, from this untoward generation, this perverse generation. And I'm told that a lot of the linguists say that the passive is more accurate to the language of the text. But either way, we do have a responsibility to save ourselves. And the thing that we do more than anything else, if we're going to save ourselves, is acknowledge the fact that we cannot save ourselves. That we're going to have to allow God to save us. We have to abandon any kind of notion that we may have that somehow we could get to be good enough or smart enough or intelligent enough or qualified enough or experienced enough or in some other fashion good enough so that God will look at us and say, well, heaven clearly will not be heaven without that. If he's not going to be saved, then who could possibly be saved? I want to put myself in that position. You're never going to put yourself in that position. And it's a failing for us to try. What we need to do, while we're pursuing holiness, while we're pursuing obedience, absolutely, remember that he is the one who saves the darkest of sinners when they turn to him in trusting in obedient faith. Now, you do have to turn to him. You have to choose to get on board this train. But if someone were to give you free train ticket to Nashville or Chicago or wherever it is you might want to go, and give it and put it in your hot little hand, and you manage to muster enough initiative to go to the train platform and get on the train and stay in your seat without jumping off until you get to your destination, that's fine as far as that goes. And you wouldn't have gotten there if you hadn't done that. But you don't consider yourself to have earned your trip. It was a gift. It was given to you by God. In Philippians chapter 2, verse number 12 and 13, Paul puts it in remarkable language here, I think, explaining to us not only what our role is, but what God's role is. So then, my beloved, Paul writes, verse number 12, just as you have always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your salvation with fear and trembling. Okay, there's your responsibility, right? Work out. That's active. That's not passive. With fear and trembling. Realize how serious this is. Realize the magnitude of your responsibility. But also, verse 13, for it is God who is at work in you both to will and to work for his good pleasure. See, your ability to turn toward God is a grace that was given to you. God gave you this opportunity. He gave you motivation. And now by pursuing his will, you are acting on his behalf, accomplishing in your life the things that God has planned for you. The things that God has destined for you, predestined sometimes we say. This is what God is doing for us, working out his good will, his good pleasure in us. And in this process, we always give him the glory. The gods that we choose cannot get us where we want to go. And I don't think that there would be anybody here who would actively oppose me in this. Well, we're going to talk a lot about modern day gods here this morning. And I'm not talking about the little statuettes, you know, the things you keep under mantle or whatever. That's not really as relevant a point. There may be a sermon there. But the gods that I'm more concerned about are those things
abstractions, worldly principles that draw us away from God. Maybe not standing directly in opposition to God, but are as an interesting side note that become the main attraction in our life. The weeds that Jesus alludes to in the parable of the sower, the things that get cluttered up in our life, that somehow or another get to be more important than what we're supposed to be planting, what God is planting in our lives. We say, I'm not going to ask for a show of hands here, but I bet you I'd get pretty close to 100%. How many of us really, more than anything else, if we're going to get on a train that takes us to any place, we'd go on the train that takes us to heaven? Right? That's what we want, right? We all want to go to heaven here. Right? I need a couple of nodding out there. We want to go to heaven, right? Okay. Which God is going to get us there? Well, I would argue that the God who's trying to get us there is going to get us there. The other gods, not only are they incapable, they're not interested in getting us to heaven. And so therefore, we need to double down on our commitment to the real God, the true God, who has our interests, our heavenly interests in mind, and we need to back off, if not back away, completely from these other kind of gods. And I'll give you a couple of examples here. And I'm not anti-education. I'm proud of my education. But I will say this very quickly. My very favorite memory verse when I was in college, maybe yours as well, Ecclesiastes chapter 12, verse 12, the writing of many books is endless. You know, there's always another book to read. There's always something else to study. You get one degree, they'll offer to sell you another one. That's the way that it works in this world. And that's fine as far as that goes. But if you put your confidence ultimately, even your heavenly confidence in your secular education, you're putting it in the wrong place. You cannot educate yourself in the conventional sense of the word educate into a right relationship with God or into a heavenly home. It doesn't work that way. In fact, I have seen far too many of my brethren pursue even a spiritual education in a human format, college format, whatever, that wound up doing far more harm than good. You realize, of course, I'm sure you're aware, Harvard, Princeton, Yale, all these types of, these started out as colleges of divinity. All of them did. The main purpose of these colleges was to educate people in the Bible, to train preachers, to get them ready to go out there and serve their religious community. All the American colleges were. I'm not quite sure about the European ones. But this was the purpose, the main purpose of higher education. And nowadays you can go to Princeton Theological Seminary, whatever it's called. There's still a college of religion there, but they don't believe in God. They sure don't believe in the Bible. And I don't think for a second that our brethren's efforts at secular education has reached that point, or that it's going to reach that point. I don't know what the future holds. But I do know that we can become so enamored of this notion of education that we take our eyes off of Jesus, that we think our salvation somehow or another is inside of ourselves, just activated in our brain. And God is telling us over and over and over again, it's exactly the opposite. Our relationship with God is based on our confidence in Him rather than acquiring more confidence in ourselves. It can get to be an actually dangerous kind of thing. And we're told that, and this isn't my opinion, this is what the Apostle Paul says, himself a very educated person. He writes in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 26, and following, for consider your calling, brethren, that there are not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble, but God has chosen the foolish things of the world to shame the wise, and God has chosen the weak things of the world to shame the things which are strong, and the base things of the world and the despised God has chosen, the things that are not, the basket of deplorables, as it were, so that he may nullify the things that are, so that no man may boast before God. What he's saying here is not that if you get an education, you're going to go to hell. That's not the point.
The point is, you train yourself to trust in yourself to find answers. You train yourself to believe that you yourself have the key to unlocking all this understanding. And you go exactly the opposite direction of where God is trying to take you. God doesn't want you to rely on yourself. God wants you to rely on Him. And the more confidence we put in ourselves, the more like the world we become. Money is maybe the most famous God, the most popular God of our society. There are not 67 verses in 1 Timothy chapter 6. I apologize, that's a typo. Apparently it was not my day yesterday. But I'll turn to verse number 6 of 1 Corinthians chapter 6. Godliness actually is a means of great gain when accompanied by a contentment, for we have brought nothing into the world so that we can take nothing out of it either. If we have food and covering, with these we shall be content. But those who want to get rich fall in temptation and a snare and many foolish and harmful desires which plunge men into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is the root of all sorts of evil. And some by longing for it have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. Now, you know this text as well as I do. And you know as many people as I do who have lost their souls because they were striving after money. You know this happens. You know this has happened. Maybe to somebody close to you. We are all aware of the danger. We all know that money is a problem, or at least a potential problem. And the love of money is a huge problem. And then we go out into the world and try to make as much money as we possibly can, thinking that somehow or another it's not going to touch us. And we all realize how inconsistent that is. We all realize that's a lot of people mess themselves up doing exactly what I'm doing. And then we all say it's not going to happen to me. Well, maybe it won't happen to you. And I pray that it won't. There's no reason that it has to happen that way. Money does not have to have become a god to you, no matter how many millions you may have in your bank account, or billions. It doesn't matter necessarily. Having money really doesn't have anything to do with having the love of money. You can love money without having any money at all. But when we allow ourselves to chase money, when we allow it to become our god, we sometimes convince, see, if I could just have enough money, then I can have security. And I don't have to worry about being homeless. I don't have to worry about my children starving. And that can free my attention up for spiritual things, which is true. And hopefully it does. Nothing wrong with that. But does it do that? Or does chasing after money simply present a whole lot of other obstacles that come along, often that directly and obviously interfere with our pursuit of God? And what do we do when that happens? Do we dial back on our pursuit of money? Double down on our commitment to God, who says, after all, He will never leave us or forsake us? Who says, if we seek His kingdom first, all the rest of these things will be added to us? God gives us those assurances. Do we have enough faith in God to allow Him to do His work in us while we're doing our work for Him? Or do we get as much money as we possibly can and keep our fingers crossed that we manage to save our faith in the process? Remember, as you're earning your paycheck, and I'm not telling you not to earn a paycheck. The Bible has things to say about that too. But as you're earning your money, as you're working in the world and taking care of your carnal obligations, do not think for a second that how much money you make has anything to do with whether you go to heaven or not. It doesn't. What you need to do is focus on heaven, allow Him to guide you, and not get distracted by these other things. God is going to carry us like a pastor. Point number two. And I said this was going to be a little bit more central to the actual text. I will carry you like a baby. Some of you have some specific knowledge, direct knowledge of what this means. Some of you were in the room with people who had direct knowledge and broke your hand in the process. This idea of birth and babies is as old as Adam and Eve. And the imagery is powerful to us. And maybe you've had occasion at some point to, and I'm talking to the men here primarily, to keep company with somebody who was maybe 6 months, 7 months into this process, maybe a little bit later, going all the way up to the very hours of delivery. And this person that you are acquainted with, presumably your wife, realizes that this whole pregnancy thing was a big mistake. You know what? We should have got a goldfish. It's not worth it. It's not worth it. All the things I'm giving up, all the weight I'm gaining, all the clothes, all this, the pain, and let's talk about the pain. A golden retriever would not hurt this much. We should have gone a different way. And you offer whatever kind of comfort you may be able to offer in a situation like this. And the greatest comfort of all is this. The knowledge, the confidence that at such and such a day, in such and such an hour, or very close to that time, there is going to be a baby. And when that baby arrives, you're not going to care about the pain. You're not going to care about the weight. You're not going to care about the inconvenience and bumping into furniture and all that. None of that's going to matter. We've got this far. If we see it to the end, it'll be worth it. And this is the story of the people of Israel. God is birthing a baby. And the nation of Israel is struggling, and has from the beginning, with the trail of childbirth. God, though, has a long-term plan. And he knows that at the end of this journey, this nation is going to accomplish what it was always intended to be. It's going to be the birthing vessel of the Christ child. The salvation of the world is going to come through Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But not today, and not tomorrow. It's going to take a while for this to happen. And what you need to do while you're waiting, and while occasionally you're suffering, is to be patient, and to trust in God, and not lose faith, not lose heart, not lose focus. God has started this process. He will finish this process. He calls himself in Revelation 1 verse 8, the Alpha and the Omega. You're probably aware of this. This is the first and last letter of the Hebrew, of the Greek alphabet, rather. Jesus calls himself the Alpha and Omega at the end of Revelation, noting the connection between himself and the Father. God starts this process in us. He will finish this process. He didn't get us pregnant just so we could be pregnant, so we could suffer. So we mourn and whine. And that's not the point. There is an end in view. And by faith, we can look to that end and believe that God is taking care of us. And that he will get us through. He loves us too much to quit on us at this point. Again, verse number 3. Isaiah 46. You have been born by me from birth and been carried from the womb. Even to your old age I will be the same. Even to your graying years I will bear you. God is going to accomplish his plan in us. A great text in Jeremiah chapter 31 verse 3 where God says, I have loved you with an everlasting love. What a wonderful concept that is. At no point does God stop loving his people, his nation. And if that's the kind of love that he has for the nation of Israel, realize that's the kind of love that he has for us as well. And yes, it's going to be a struggle sometimes, getting from here to there. But that's just the time that we increase our faith. We increase our commitment. We increase our consciousness of our need for God and need for His help. Romans 8, verse 28 through 30 talks about this eternal plan of God, the foreknown that He has known in His mind. He predestined or foreordained to be conformed to the image of His Son. That's you and me. That's what we've done. God knew about us from the beginning, exactly how and how specifically He knew about them. But He knew about His people. He knew about you and me, if you're a Christian. And He had a plan for us. That He was going to conform us to the image of His Son. And to get them into this special relationship, He called them out of the world. He justified them through the blood of His Son, Jesus Christ. And ultimately, He started this process of glorification that we see in part, in small part, in this life. But that ultimately is going to be realized in heaven. We believe that's going to happen. Because God promised. God got us into the situation. God is going to get us through this situation to this greater and more vibrant reality that waits after this life is over, after our travail is over. There is no other God that can do this for you. There is no other God that loves you like a husband loves his wife, like a father loves his child. These gods are conceptual. They are impersonal. They are incapable of having a relationship. Now, you can have a relationship with them. You may be the biggest Alabama Crimson Tide fan or New Orleans Saints or Houston Astros, you know, whatever it happens to be. You may give your heart and soul, almost literally. I was you ever have one of these teams that moved on you? We lived in the Houston area for a while. I was a big Houston Oilers fan growing up. And the owner decided to move. He didn't ask me. He didn't care. I'm sure that calling me and my family never crossed his mind. He had a plan, he had a vision, he had an idea, and he did it. And there were a lot of people like me, a lot of them that were a lot louder than me, who had a great deal to say about this. And Mr. Adams just kind of nodded, thank you for your input, and they did whatever he wanted to do. That's what happens with the gods of this world. They do not have an investment in you. I love the language that the proverb writer tells us, and this is talking about women and about carnality in general. But you know, you could argue that sex is the biggest god of all as far as this kind of thing goes. And after having said verse number 18 and 19, three things are too wonderful for me, four which I do not understand: the way of an eagle in the sky, the way of a serpent on a rock, the way of a ship in the middle of the sea, and the way of a man with a maid. How inexpressibly wonderful it is to have things that work the way they're supposed to work, in the context they're supposed to work. A husband and wife is the best example of all of that. That's when it's all working right. The contrast in verse number 20, this is the way of the adulterous woman. She eats and wipes her mouth and says, I've done no wrong. She will chew you up and spit you out and not care. Now, that has profound application with regard to dating and marriage and courtship and all of that. But it has deeper applications for those who would see God's plan, God's vision for how your life ought to be, and say, you know what, I got a better idea. I got a more fun idea. I really love whatever it happens to be. The more you give yourself to these gods, the less and less it'll matter in the big picture. They have no long-term investment in us. And I suggest to you, as someone who's been down this road a little bit,
and live to tell the tale. That you would do well to reconsider having a long-term investment in them. How committed are we to carnal things? How much do we get passionate about our favorite rock band? Or, you know, our favorite social activity? Our favorite novelist? Whatever it happens to be. Video games. We get so caught up in these things. We love them. We get emotional about them. They don't care about us. Maybe we should reserve the majority of our emotion, the majority of our commitment to the one who carries us like a baby, who has loved us before we were born and will love us long after we die. The one who is truly committed to us. The one who carries us. And third point, the one that I said that might have come immediately to mind. God promises to carry us like a cripple. I don't know if any of you have ever been in a situation like this where you could not walk or you could barely walk. And you had the opportunity to lean on somebody and kind of hobble somehow or another from here to there, get to where you needed to be. And how grateful you were to have that person you could lean on. You know, the great story about Moses in Exodus, about how when his hands were up, the people of God were carrying the battle, and his hands drooped, the people suffered. And Aaron and Hur, a man who doesn't occur anywhere else in the scriptures, stand there and literally prop Moses' arms up, holding up his hands, so that the people of God would prevail. Having people like that, who will be there for you, be that kind of support for you, this makes all the difference in the world. And if we can rejoice in having humans that will do that for us in some small, short-term way, how much more magnificent is it to serve a God who carries us when we need Him the most, when we are broken, when we are hurt, when we are downtrodden, and incapable of moving from here to there, it seems. God is willing and eager to intervene and lift us up and carry us. What a wonderful thing that is. Now, comments like this that I've just made, which is scripture, are oftentimes kind of the jumping off point to some highly emotional, feel-good kind of sermon or kind of sub-sermon that is intended to help you, you know, love God and connect to God and believe that all your problems are going to be solved if you just trust in God. And then they usually pass the plate and put a chip. There's some of that. There's a Bible point to be made for trusting in God like that. And there's no doubt that God carries us in a very real and profound way, in ways that we probably cannot appreciate in this life. But I want to talk about therapy. I want to talk about discipline and training. And the crutch or the support or the help that God offers when we need it the most. When God offers us help, when we are crippled, when we are hurting, when we are broken, it may not look like we want it to look. And I'll just put that out there for you. It may be that you are, in your own mind anyway, wanting nothing more and nothing less than simply for Hal to get up there in the pulpit and talk for 20 minutes about how wonderful it is to be a Christian and how God's going to take care of you and you don't have anything to worry about. And I'm not going to say that. Instead, I'm going to say that the help that God offers you, especially when you really, really need the help, more often than not, is going to be miserable. It's going to be horrible. There are going to be times when you wish you could just stay hurt instead of go through what God's putting you through. I may have told you about this. But we have visitors, so you have heard the stories. I'll tell you the stories. We used to be the place where we used to be, there was a woman who had shoulder surgery. And she was scheduled for, I think, a three-month rehab. It wound up taking, I think it was 8 months. And as it turns out, this woman was not a big fan of pain. Okay? Maybe you can relate. I'm not a big fan of pain necessarily either. But her idea of rehabilitation was to do what the doctor told her until it hurt a lot, and then she would stop it. And she was wondering 3 months, 4 months, 5 months into this process why she wasn't getting any better. And I was trying my hardest to mind my own business and say, it's none of my business. But if she had asked my opinion, I said, well, as a matter of fact, I think I know exactly what the problem is. Therapy is not about avoiding pain. Therapy, quite frankly, is about inflicting pain. And that is tough for us because our instinct is to avoid pain. Pain is this impulse that God put in us to protect us. If we are doing something and it hurts, that's our body's way of saying you need to stop doing that thing. And generally speaking, we do. But there are times, and you all know about this, most of you have been through this to one degree or another. There are times when you have to deliberately inflict pain on your body. Not in such a way as to damage your body, but to help your body through a very difficult time to get you from an unacceptable place into an acceptable place and a profitable place. This is what God does for us, and it's not always pleasant. Hebrews chapter 12. I'll read a small section of this, dealing with this topic. In verse number 11, "For they disciplined us, that is our fathers, for a short time as seemed best to them. But he, God, disciplines us for our good, so that we may share his holiness. All discipline for the moment seems not to be joyful, but sorrowful. Yet to those who have been trained by it, afterward it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness." We're thinking long term. We're thinking about God's agenda, not our agenda. How many times have you seen somebody who just won the gold medal, and the reporter goes and says, "You know, how did you get here? What was the key to your success?" "Well, the key to my success was I just did whatever I wanted to do. I just kind of followed my instincts, and if I felt like waking up early, if I felt like working out, if I felt like practicing or whatever, then I did, and if I didn't, I just kind of played, I'll stop." And here I am! No, that's not the way it works. You discipline yourself. You say very unkind things about your coach, behind his back. You resent the daylights out of him, but you do it. You do the work. Because you know, no matter how bitter you may be against the one who's calling the shots right now, you know that that person knows better than you do. And if you will trust in him, you have an excellent chance of getting where you want to be. Now, the difference is, when you listen to God, in his training regimen, you know 100% that you will win the gold medal. If you will trust in him, if you will go where he tells you to go, you will succeed in this. But it's going to hurt. It means you're going to have to work harder than you're working, not less hard. Do not grow weary in well-doing. You shall reap if you do not grow weary, he says in Galatians 6, verse 9. Work harder, not less hard. When you experience pain in this life in the service of Jesus Christ, that pain is a sign of success, not a sign of failure. At least in certain contexts it is. 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 16, if anyone suffers as a Christian, he's not to be ashamed. But let him glorify God in that name. I'm being a Christian and I'm suffering. Surely something has gone wrong here. No, that's not the way it works. It may very well be the plan is working exactly the way it's supposed to work. But it's causing me pain. That can't be a good thing. Maybe it can be a good thing. Maybe that's a sign that the training is actually starting to work. That you're actually... Let's be honest about this. If you're a Christian that never makes any waves, if you're a Christian that never speaks up for his faith, a Christian that does not act like a Christian, just kind of mind your own business, you can exist in your suburban neighborhood interacting with your neighbors, your schoolmates, or whatever, for 20 years, and never have a lick of trouble because of your faith. In fact, you probably will. It's not because you're doing it right. It's because you're doing it wrong. Pain is part of the process. Pain is part of the development. God promises, if you will endure to the end, you'll overcome Satan, self, and sin. Overcome. Then you can come over and be with me. Revelation 2 verse 10. Other passages in Revelation as well talk about the same idea. If you can endure unto death, until death, then you will be saved. The gods that we are choosing in this world, and I've probably beat this drum a fair amount in the last year or so, and deliberately so, because I see more and more in our worldly society our brethren not only adopting the habits of the world around us, but not being embarrassed about it. In fact, being rather excited about it. The gods that you choose are the problem. They are not the solution. I realize that we can convince ourselves that we can have our cake and eat it too, and to a certain degree, maybe we can. But this is not about finding an existence here on earth where we're not in any pain, where we're happy all the time. I realize that all of us, all things being equal, would prefer to be happy than be miserable, right? I'm not speaking out of turn here, I don't think. We'd all rather be happy, and that's fine. There is certainly a biblical concept of joy. But feeling better about ourselves, having some preacher get up in the pulpit and say, peace, peace, when there is no peace, is not going to fix the problem. My job as a preacher is not to make you feel better about yourself. My job is to help you get closer to God. And that may involve making you feel worse about yourself. That's not what I'm trying to do. I'm not trying to guilt trip people. I'm not trying to stick burrs under people's saddles just for the sheer joy of doing so. That's not the point at all. But we must all do, preachers and non-preachers alike, we must all do what we must, what we can, what we should, to encourage one another along God's path. And that may involve doing an uncomfortable thing. That may involve asking somebody else to give up something that they love. Feeling better about ourselves is not going to cure what is really ailing us. If we will continue along this path, if we continue to do what feels good in the short term, wear what we like, go where we want, sleep as late as we want, give as much to the Lord as we feel like giving, whatever makes us happy, whatever makes us content, whatever gets us by today, this week, this month, this year. The longer and the deeper you get into this pattern, the more and more difficult it becomes for you to look at the world in the long term. You take your eyes off of heaven, you quit thinking about heaven. One of these days, you're not going to heaven. Now, I'm not going to be your judge in such a day. I don't want to be confused on that point. But realize what has happened to many, many of our brethren throughout the years, throughout the centuries. People who gave themselves to the Lord and then gave themselves to the world. God sees your difficulties. God sees your struggles. God sees your pain and your difficulty and your disappointment. And God will get you through it if you will do it His way. Now, you can be the most comfortable paraplegic in the world, or you can learn to walk. That's your choice. God is trying to get you to walk. God's trying to get you to be better than you are, and ultimately bound for heaven. And if you will do things His way, He promises, He assures you, that He will carry you to that destination. You just have to believe in Him. You just have to trust. You just have to follow His voice as He guides you toward heavenly glory. And accept whatever price may have to be paid along the way. Jesus said, those who give up their life will save it. It's the ones who try to save their life who are going to lose it.
So if you're ready to give your life to Jesus Christ today, if you are ready to turn your life over to your Heavenly Father and allow Him to have His way with you, if you believe in your heart that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, then please respond to the Lord's invitation. Make your life right with Him in whatever may be necessary. If you haven't been baptized yet, then do that. If you've been struggling with your faith, if you need encouragement and help from your brethren, then ask for that. Whatever we can do to help you walk with Christ and ultimately achieve your heavenly goal, please respond while we stand and sing to encourage you at this time.